Greetings, readers. In fact, season's greetings, readers. I'm Eileen Charles, and this is the Book Report. And can you believe it is already December? Yep, it's a busy time. It seems I'm spending so much time in the car, visiting shops, uptown, downtown, looking for those perfect gifts. I'm getting ready for holiday gatherings all over. Luckily, I can slip in an audiobook into the CD player and enjoy those extended hours behind the wheel. I bet your experience is similar just now. Audiobooks make it all bearable, don't they? Today, I have a very special show for you. We are going to be meeting two of the biggest names in audiobook narration, Barbara Rosenblatt and Simon Vance. I've even selected two of my favorite books that they've narrated to preview for you. And as holiday gift-giving is on everyone's mind just now, we are going to delve into other new audio releases that will make a very welcome addition under the tree or the menorah. So sit back, relax, and let me be your guide.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Readers, I am thrilled to introduce you to Barbara Rosenblatt, one of the most beloved narrators of audiobooks in the country. Her extraordinary range of accents and abilities has earned her 8 Audie Awards from the Audio Publishers Association. It's like their Oscars. In fact, Billboard magazine has said Barbara is spoken of with the same reverence and affection that the music industry reserves for Frank Sinatra and the Beatles. Barbara trained as an actress, working in both England and the States. On Broadway, she created the role of Mrs. Medlock in the Tony Award-winning musical The Secret Garden. She's also appeared in episodes of The Guiding Light and Law and Order. I will listen to anything Barbara narrates, and I know that when you listen to any of her performances, you'll become a devotee too. Welcome, Barbara. You do such an amazing job of bringing the characters to life. In a series like Amelia Peabody, how do you keep all the characters' voices straight? Do you keep a list of characteristics, like Emerson and his harumphs? What do you do?
I have what one fan once called phonographic memory. I try to, once I've established who the characters are all going to be, I sort of have them in my head as my little palette of colors, so to speak, as I'm prepping the book. And, of course, now with the technology that we have, if I have an odd character that appears in Chapter 3 and won't appear again till Chapter 47, I can bookmark this person and then refer back to it and go, oh, what did I do with this guy? Oh, yeah, okay, and move on.
And how actually do you prep for a book? How long does it take, and what do you do?
I have a very comfy chair in my home, and the apartment is quiet enough that I can sit and read. I read slowly. I go through the book with the same intent as anybody reading the book for the first time would have it, which is to be entertained, to be surprised, to follow the author's arcs until I get to the end, at which point the audio canvas sort of presents itself in my head. I've prepared a word list for research of names and place names that I can't pronounce send that in for research, and I'm ready to go.
How do you do a believable male voice?
Well, you know, this is the problem at parties. People say, oh, you do such great male voices. Go and do one. And, you know, out of context, it makes absolutely no sense at all. The whole point of a good audio recording is nuanced approaches to different characters so that the listener doesn't believe that they're hearing only one voice because I have led you astray. Oh, it's so manipulative. And so I have an opportunity because I have a fairly wide range to go from down here, playing Emerson, you know, pour me another whiskey, Emerson, to little children and babies and strange creatures.
Hmm. And what input, if any, do you and other narrators get from the author?
Actually, having done this a long, long time, there are some authors out there who actually seek me out for their recordings because, you know, they become fans over the years, God bless them. And so I have a relationship with people like Elizabeth Peters. And, in fact, we had a good old chinwag last week just to catch up on how she's doing and how I'm doing, and we've become friends over the years and mutual fans. And so when a new book of hers, for example, comes along, I can call her up and say, hey, what version of ancient Egyptian is that, and how do you pronounce it? And can you give me a little bit more insight into this particular character, which is incredibly useful for somebody like me who treats the audiobook project as a collaborative effort.
Well, what happens when you read a book that you know you're going to narrate and it's kind of a sleeper and you thought it wasn't so well written and it's a little bit slow? What do you do to get yourself up for that?
Well, you see, that is the art of audiobooks. And a good audiobook in trained and gifted hands can elevate subpar material to something brand new. I can't tell you how many times people have written to me saying, I would never have written this book, even on an airplane ride, grabbing it at the airport, had it not been for your recording of it. Because, for example, if I have a mystery, and you know how many times you've picked up a book and it isn't that stellar, and you read it and you see this one character sort of early on and you think, oh, come on, it's so obvious. That's the guy who did it. Oh, please, come on, come on. But in the hands of a decent recording artist, you can take that character and sort of lead the ears away from that possibility, questioning whether or not that he is, in fact, the perpetrator of whatever crime it is you're dealing with in this book, and move it along and retain interest and keep your audience amused and engaged for the entire book.
And have you ever thought about writing a book yourself?
Oh, people have asked. I've read so many genres of books, you know, from romances and classics and mysteries and this, that, and the other, so many of them, that they can be somewhat formulaic, I have to say. And I actually played with the idea once with a producer friend of mine who had produced so many of them with me and said, you know, we could sit down, we could write one of these, you know, make a fortune. And then I thought, you know, that's an agony I don't think I could handle, because my particular skills and my love is interpretation. So rather than being the composer of the classical piece of music, I'd rather be the pianist interpreting.
Well, you certainly do a great job. What would you tell folks who are interested now in getting into the narration business?
Well, the narration business is a very, very general topic. What you're saying is voice acting involves a whole bunch of different skills. I'm a voice actor, which means my particular quiver of arrows includes voiceovers and documentaries, and I've been the voice in museums of art exhibits, you know, where you pick up that little phone and you push 802 and you hear somebody saying, Edward Hopper, this is Nighthawks. It was painted in blah, 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 you know?
Yes.
Stuff like that. Each one of these particular jobs requires a different skill set. One of the largest in audiobook recording being endurance, because you have to sit there over several days, and the listener should have the feeling that you've been chained to that microphone from chapter one through to the end.
What project are you working on now?
Well, yesterday I started what's got to be one of the most challenging jobs I've ever been offered, which is I am recording the new international version of the New Testament.
Oh.
The whole thing. I got through Matthew and halfway through Mark yesterday. I have Luke and John and Romans and Corinthians. It's pretty good for a nice Jewish girl. And so I've just begun that, and I have another long day in the studio today doing that. And the new international version is wonderful because I'm treating it as an audio book. I mean, these are classic stories of history and faith, which work very well in audio. So it's kind of interesting being the voice of God.
Well, and when you don't have a project or when you're done for the day, what actually do you pick up and read for pleasure?
Well, I have a stack of stuff that I've been, you know, trying to get to every now and again. I recorded a book that won an Audi for me some years ago called Jackdaws, and it was written by a guy called Ken Follett. And when I went out to L.A. for the awards, a friend of mine gave me another Ken Follett book called Pillars of the Earth. And I had never read it, and he said, oh, it's fabulous. And I had heard from so many people that it was one of their favorite books. I said, oh, okay, what's it about? The building of a cathedral. Really? He said, just give it 100 pages, because it's like 1,000 pages long. And I started reading it, and I was missing subway stops reading this thing. It was so engaging, because I love Ken Follett. I think he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. But that took me well over a year to read, because one way or another, I'm prepping other stuff, preparing other recordings, and reading lots of other things. So actually reading for pleasure, I don't get the opportunity as much as I'd like.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I've read that Follett book, too, and enjoyed it. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for visiting with us today. It's so great talking to you. I'm a fan, that's for sure.
That warms the cockles of my heart. And if there's one thing I can't stand, it's cold cockles. Have a happy holiday.
You, too. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Readers, if there are mystery lovers on your list, I've got the most enjoyable gift idea for them. A volume of any of the Amelia Peabody series by Elizabeth Peters, read by none other than our guest today, Barbara Rosenblatt. Now in the series, our heroine is an unflappable British lady of considerable character who inherited two things from her father: a considerable fortune and an unbendable will. The history of Mrs. Amelia Peabody Emerson is an amazing saga, encompassing three generations, a world war, and 35 years of turbulent yet extremely entertaining history. It all begins in Crocodile on the Sandbank, Book 1. That's set in 1884 with Amelia's first trip to Egypt. Our heroine finds both a career and true love in the land of the pharaohs. Amelia's love of Egypt almost equals her love for her hot-tempered but extremely handsome husband, archaeologist Radcliffe Emerson. She joins him in his annual excavations, which, except for a few brief hiatuses, continue for 35 years and 19 books, with this year's addition to this series, A River in the Sky. New characters are being introduced all the time, including Amelia and Radcliffe's son, Walter Peabody Emerson. He is better known by his nickname of Ramses, given him by his father because he was as swarthy as an Egyptian and as arrogant as a pharaoh. Here's an interesting note, readers. Elizabeth Peters, the author, is actually a nom de plume for Barbara Mertz, who also writes under the name of Barbara Michaels. She actually has a PhD in Egyptology. Now, let's listen to Crocodile on the Sandbank, read by Barbara Rosenblatt.
My brothers were successful merchants and professional men. One and all, they rejected father's studies. I was left then to be the prop of my father's declining years. As I have said, the life suited me. It allowed me to develop my talents for scholarship. But let not the gentle reader suppose that I was ill-equipped for the practical necessities of life. My father was disinclined toward practicalities. It was left to me to bully the baker and badger the butcher, which I did, if I may say so, quite effectively. After Mr. Hodgkins the butcher, Pierrot gave me no trouble. My father died eventually, if one may use so precise a word for the process that took place. One might say that he gradually shriveled up and ran down. The rumor, put about by a pert housemaid, that he had actually been dead for 2 days before anyone noticed, is a complete exaggeration. I must admit, however, that he might have passed away at any point during the 5 hours I spent with him in his study on that particular afternoon. He was leaning back in his big leather chair, meditating, as I assumed, and when, warned by some premonition, I hurried to his side, his wide-open eyes held the same expression of mild inquiry with which they had always regarded me. It seemed to me quite a respectable and comfortable way in which to pass on. It came as no surprise to anyone to discover that he had left his property to me, the aforesaid prop, and the only one of his children who had not an income of its own. My brothers accepted this tolerantly, as they had accepted my devoted service to Papa. They did not explode until they learned that the property was not a paltry sum, but a fortune of £500,000. They had made a common mistake in assuming that an absent-minded scholar is necessarily a fool. My father's disinclination to argue with Mr. Hodgkins, the butcher, was due not to lack of ability, but to disinterest. He was very much interested in investments, change, and those other mysterious matters that produce wealth. He had conducted his business affairs with the same reticence that marked his habits in general, and he died, to the surprise of all, a wealthy man. When this fact became known, the explosion occurred. My eldest brother, James, went so far as to threaten legal proceedings on the basis of unsound mind and undue influence. This ill-considered burst of temper, which was characteristic of James, was easily stopped by Mr. Fletcher, Papa's excellent solicitor. Other attempts ensued. I was visited by streams of attentive nieces and nephews, assuring me of their devotion, which had been demonstrated over the past years by their absence. Sisters-in-law invited me in the most affectionate phrases to share their homes. I was warned in the strongest terms against fortune-hunters. The warnings were not unselfish. They were, however, unnecessary. A middle-aged spinster, for I was at that time 32 years of age, and I scorned to disguise the fact, who has never received a proposal of marriage, must be a simpleton if she fails to recognize the sudden acquisition of a fortune as a factor in her new popularity. I was not a simpleton. I had always known myself to be plain. The transparent attempts of my kin and of various unemployed gentlemen to win my regard aroused in me a grim amusement. I did not put them off. Quite the contrary. I encouraged them to visit and laughed up my sleeve at their clumsy efforts. Then it occurred to me that I was enjoying them too much. I was becoming cynical, and it was this character development that made me decide to leave England. Not, as some malicious persons have intimated, a fear of being overborne. I had always wanted to travel. Now I decided I would see all the places Father had studied, the glory that was Greece and the grandeur that was Rome, Babylon and hundred-gated Thebes. Once I had made this decision, it did not take me long to prepare for the journey. I made my arrangements with Mr. Fletcher, and received from him a proposal of marriage, which I refused with the same good humour that had characterised the offer. At least he was honest. "I thought it worth a try," he remarked calmly. "Nothing ventured, nothing gained," I agreed. Mr. Fletcher studied me thoughtfully for a moment. "Miss Amelia, may I ask, in my professional capacity now, whether you have any inclinations toward matrimony?" "None," I disapprove of matrimony as a matter of principle. Mr. Fletcher's pepper and salt eyebrows lifted. I added, for myself, that is. I suppose it is well enough for some women. What else can the poor things do? But why should any independent, intelligent female choose to subject herself to the whims and tyrannies of a husband? I assure you, I have yet to meet a man as sensible as myself. I can well believe that, said Mr. Fletcher. He hesitated for a moment. I fancied I could see him struggle with the desire to make an unprofessional statement. He lost the struggle. Why do you wear such frightful clothes? He burst out. If it is to discourage suitors... Really, Mr. Fletcher, I exclaimed. I beg your pardon, said the lawyer, wiping his brow. I cannot think what came over me. Nor can I. As for my clothes, they suit the life I lead. The current fashions are impractical for an active person. Skirts so tight one must toddle like an infant. Bodices boned so firmly it is impossible to draw a deep breath. And bustles! Of all the idiotic contrivances foisted upon helpless womankind, the bustle is certainly the worst. I wear them since it is impossible to have a gown made without them, but at least I can insist on sensible dark fabrics and a minimum of ornament. What a fool I should look in puffs and frills and crimson satin, or a gown trimmed with dead birds like one I saw. And yet, said Mr. Fletcher, smiling, I have always thought you would look rather well in puffs and frills and crimson satin. The opportunity to lecture had restored my good humor. I returned his smile, but I shook my head.
I said we'd also talk about great audiobook gifts, and it so happens that the rock and roll biography genre is really hot at the moment, so we'll mention a few of those. Life by Keith Richards is a new title causing quite a stir. As lead guitarist of the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards created the riffs, the lyrics, and the songs that rouse the world, like those in Honky Tonk Woman and Jumpin' Jack Flash. A true original, Richards has always walked his own path, spoken his mind, and done things his way. Now, Richard pauses to tell his story in one of the most anticipated autobiography in decades. The Stones found fame and success as a bad boy band, and they were constantly in trouble with the authorities. Keith tells the inside story of arrest and imprisonment for drug possession, tax exile in France. His is a story of ever-increasing fame, isolation, and addiction. Through it all, Richards remained devoted to the music of the band, until even that was challenged by Mick Jagger's attempt at a solo career, leading to a decade of conflicts and ultimately the biggest reunion tour in history. In a voice that is uniquely and unmistakably his, part growl, part laugh, Keith Richards brings us a true rock and roll life of our times, unfettered, fearless, and true. Life by Keith Richards, read by Johnny Depp with Joe Hurley and featuring Keith Richards.
In the whole of the United States, there was perhaps no sillier place to stop with a car loaded with drugs. A conservative, redneck southern community not happy to welcome different-looking strangers. In the car with me were Ronnie Wood, Freddie Sessler, an incredible character, my friend and almost a father to me, who will have many parts in this story, and Jim Callaghan, the head of our security for many years. We were driving the 400 miles from Memphis to Dallas, where we had our next gig the following day at the Cotton Bowl. Jim Dickinson, the southern boy who played piano on Wild Horses, had told us that the Texarkana landscape was worth the car ride, and we were planed out. We'd had a scary flight from Washington to Memphis, dropping suddenly many thousands of feet with much sobbing and screaming. The photographer, Annie Leibovitz, hitting her head on the roof, and the passengers kissing the tarmac when we landed. I was seen going to the back of the plane and consuming substances with more than usual dedication as we tossed about the skies, not wanting to waste. So we drove, and Ronnie and I had been particularly stupid. We pulled into this roadhouse called the Fordyce, where we sat down and ordered, and then Ronnie and I went to the John. You know, just start me up. We got high. We didn't fancy the clientele out there or the food, and so we hung in the John, laughing and carrying on. We sat there for 40 minutes, and you don't do that down there. Not then. That's what excited and exacerbated the situation. And the staff called the cops. As we pulled out, there was this black car parked on the side. No number plate. And the minute we took off, 20 yards down the road, we get sirens and the little blinking light, and there they are with shotguns in our faces. I had a denim cap with all these pockets in it that were filled with dope. Everything was filled with dope. In the car doors themselves, all you had to do was pop the panels, and there were plastic bags full of coke and grass, peyote and mescaline. Oh my God, how are we going to get out of this? It was the worst time to get busted. It was a miracle we had been allowed into the States at all for this tour. Our visas hung on a thread of conditions, as every police force in the big cities also knew, and had been fixed by Bill Carter with very hard, long-distance footwork with the State Department and the Immigration Service over the previous 2 years. It was obviously condition zero that we weren't arrested for possession of narcotics, and Carter was responsible for guaranteeing this. I wasn't taking the heavy shit at the time. I'd cleaned up for the tour. And I could have just put all that stuff on the plane. To this day, I cannot understand why I bothered to carry all that crap around and take that chance. People had given me all this stuff in Memphis, and I was loath to give it away. But I still could have put it on the plane and driven clean. Why did I load the car like some pretend dealer? Maybe I woke up too late for the plane. I know I spent a long time opening up the panels, stashing this shit. But peyote's not particularly my line of substances anyway. In the cap's pockets, there's hash, two and alls, some coke. I greet the police with a flourish of the cap and throw pills and hash into the bushes. Hello, officer. Flourish. Oh, have I broken some local law? Pray forgive me, I'm English. Was I driving on the wrong side of the road? And you've already got them on the back foot. And you've got rid of your crap, but only some of it. They saw a hunting knife lying on the seat and would later decide to take that as evidence of a concealed weapon. The lying bastards. And then they made us follow them to a car park somewhere beneath City Hall. As we drove, they watched us, surely, throwing more of our shit into the road. They didn't do a search immediately when we got to the garage. They said to Ronnie, okay, you go in the car and bring out your stuff. Ronnie had a little handbag or something in the car, but at the same time, he tipped all the crap he had into a Kleenex box. And as he got out, he said to me, it's under the driver's seat. And when I go in, I didn't have anything in the car to get. All I've got to do is pretend that I have something and take care of this box. But I didn't know what the fuck to do with it. So basically, I just scrunched it up a bit and I put it under the back seat. And I walked out and said, well, I don't have anything. The fact that they didn't tear the car apart is beyond me.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
I don't think I'm easy to talk about. I've got a very irregular head. And that, dear listeners, is a very unusual quote from an unusual musician who was a founding member of Pink Floyd. Roger Keith Sid Barrett was the definition of a golden boy. With good looks and an aptitude for music, he was a charismatic child who fast became a teenage leader in England in the 1960s. Along with three school chums, Roger Waters, Richard Wright, and Nick Mason, he formed what would become Pink Floyd. Starting as a British cover band, they soon pioneered a new sound, British psychedelic rock. With early, trippy, Barrett-penned hits, Pink Floyd captured London in all its technicolor glory. But there was a dark side. Barrett fell in with some hardcore hippies and began taking large quantities of LSD. His already fragile mental state, most believed him to be a schizophrenic, further unraveled. The once bright-eyed lad was quickly replaced by a sinister, dead-eyed shadow of his former self, given to eccentric, reclusive, and sometimes violent behavior. Sacked from the band, Barrett retreated to his mother's house, where he remained until his death, rarely seen or rarely heard. The band replaced Sid with David Gilmour, but they never forgot him, and their next few albums often touched on the subject of insanity. One of the most revered rock albums of all times, Dark Side of the Moon, was inspired by Sid's descent into mental illness. A Very Irregular Head by Rob Chapman, a musician and rock journalist, lifts the veil of secrecy that has surrounded Sid Barrett for nearly four decades. Drawing on exclusive access to the family, friends, archives, journals, letters, and artwork, this is the definitive portrait of a brilliant, tragic artist. In a few minutes, we'll meet the renowned narrator, Simon Vance. First, let's listen to Simon Vance's narration of Sid Barrett's story.
I saw Sid Barrett playing live just the once. It was the now infamous Stars at Cambridge Corn Exchange gig in February 1972, when Sid's short-lived music career was in its final stages, and the 30 or so people who were there were bearing witness to the wake. Not that it seemed like that to me at the time. I was 17 and starry-eyed, and there he was a few feet in front of me. I wrote a suitably starry-eyed review of the performance for the fan magazine Terrapin. We didn't call them fanzines then, not realizing at the time that it would constitute the last ever review of a Sid Barrett gig. Although I didn't know that it was all over for Sid, I had by then already realized that it was all over for the 60s. I pressed my nose up to the sweet shop window of the Underground often enough to realize that there was nothing much going on inside. The goods had gone bad. The sweets gone sour. Whichever analogy you want to use, it was pretty clear by 1972 that some sort of dream was over. What I didn't realize for many years was that for Sid Barrett it was pretty much over from the moment it started. That man I saw on Top of the Pops 3 weeks in a row in the summer of 1967, in his tight Hendrix perm and his pop star clothes, had already fallen out of love with the idea of pop stardom. Most people didn't know half of the story then, and I didn't know any of it. As someone who only entered his teens at the tail end of 1967, pop, to me, was a magical other world. I'm glad I was 12 during the summer of love. Had I been born 10 years earlier, I might have been a blues bore, or one of those purists who thought the Beatles sold out the moment they came back from Hamburg. 10 years younger, and I'd have been getting all my knowledge of the 60s as hand-me-downs and received wisdom. As it was, turning 12 at the end of 1966 meant that I moved from Alice in Wonderland and Wind in the Willows to Strawberry Fields and See Emily Play in what seemed like the twinkling of an eye. English psychedelia was part of my Arcadia, my first musical exotica, and that sense memory with its multitude of evocations has never left me. It also means I have first-hand recollections of at least some of what I'm writing about. I remember seeing Pink Floyd perform Apples and Oranges on the hip TV show Come Here Often, and the earnest discussions at school the next day as everyone but me decreed that it wasn't as good as See Emily Play. I remember a neighbour of mine going to see the band at the newly opened Caesar's Palace in Bedford. They were billed in the Bed's Courier as Pink Lloyd, and complaining that they just played two long instrumentals and didn't perform the hits. I remember listening to Sid's last ever session with the band on John Peel's Top Gear on New Year's Eve 1967, in my bedroom through a blizzard of bad medium-wave reception on a tiny, tinny transistor radio, which is how most of us experienced the aural splendour of the 60s. I scribbled down the session's song titles, none of which were yet on record, and two of which still aren't, and one of which seemed, as far as I could tell, to be called Jock Van Blues. Soon after that radio session, Sid's pop life, like my weak PP2 batteries, seemed to go flat and would soon fizzle out altogether. Comets burn bright before expiring, and they exhibit lengthy trails. The trails of Comet Sid showered all over the early 70s and the second half of my teens. I grew up 20 miles from Cambridge and know its geography and its psychogeography intimately. A great deal of my misspent youth was misspent there, astral travelling across Parker's Peace, going to free concerts in Grantchester Meadows, wandering in the backs and the shadowed cloisters of the colleges, attempting to gate-crash May balls, drifting through the maze-like lanes where every second building seemed to be a bookshop belching out its surplus wares onto the pavement. Give or take the odd, hideous shopping complex, it is still recognisably the same place it was in the early 70s. That's the 1670s, of course. Cambridge is a small place, and it was even smaller in the early 70s. Sid's unfulfilled early promise and dreams abandoned seemed to hover over the city like a spectral presence. You didn't have to go very far to find someone who knew him or had known him. "Oh, you're into Sid Barrett, are you?" someone said to me in a pub one night in 1973. "See that guy at the bar? He taught Sid at Tech College." I made a beeline for the bar. Casual conversation ensued, none of which I can remember.
Simon Vance hails from the southern coastal town of Brighton in the English county of Sussex. While still very young, he was given his first reel-to-reel tape recorder and promptly started recording funny voices and silly noises. He has never stopped, and we are so very glad. Simon's broadcasting career began at BBC Radio Brighton in 1976 while he was studying at Leeds University. After graduation, he took on a full-time job at the BBC Radio Brighton, moving a couple of years later to London, where, for the rest of the decade, he became a newsreader and presenter for BBC Radio 4. He discovered his knack for narrating audiobooks by working for the Talking Book Service of the Royal National Institute for the Blind. In the 90s, Simon moved to California and began doing audiobooks commercially, as well as devoting a great deal of time to his growing acting career. He's had 12 Audie nominations and received 27 Earphone Awards. Vance is a prolific reader, narrating more than 500 titles to date. Few narrators display such range and versatility. From fiction classics and bestsellers to fairy tales and fantasies, the range of titles is amazing. What makes Vance such a good reader? He says that he is doing no more than simply telling the story. His reading expertly captures the intent of the author and the underlying mood and tempo of the text. Welcome, Simon. It's such a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, hi, Elaine. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Well, earlier in this show, actually, we heard you reading from A Very Irregular Head, the story of Pink Floyd's Sid Barrett. It gets me thinking that you must be a font of incredible knowledge because of the huge array of subjects you've covered. How do you keep all that reading content with you, and does it stay with you, and how do you catalog all of that?
Oh, I don't have a great memory. In terms of the books I've read, to be perfectly honest, and this goes back to my acting days as well. I know there are people out there who can quote lines from every play they've ever been in, and I'm sure there are people who remember the plots and the characters and everything of every single book they've ever read. But for me, I'm afraid it tends to go in one ear and out the other. There are books, of course, that do remain with me, and A Very Irregular Head is certainly one of those, because I grew up in the 60s, and Pink Floyd and so on were very important to me at the time in the early 70s and so on. And the story of Sid Barrett sort of struck a chord with me. It's a very sad story of a man sort of caught up in show business who perhaps didn't have the mental ability to stay in it, and he got damaged. And it's a marvelous story, and I love books like that, the nonfiction kind, who, when I've lived through it and I can recognize moments and go, oh, I remember where I was when that happened. So those books, that book particularly remains with me. I think will remain with me for a long time.
And while you were preparing for that book, did you actually get direction from the author or have any input from him?
I did call him, yes, because there were a lot of names in there that I wasn't familiar with, you know, minor characters and so on, the real people that I wanted to get right, and particularly because they were real people. And I did make contact with the author on that occasion, and he, you know, we chatted for a bit. He's about a year older than me, but he remembers all those times. Of course, he's actually a music journalist, so he's very in that world. It was a great help to get those names and so on straight. With a nonfiction book, it's not so important in terms of style and so on. You're not going to ask the author what kind of style do you want with this book or something like that. But with it's more about the factual details of, is this name right? Am I pronouncing this right? And he, in fact, because he's a writer, he put names in there that he didn't know how to pronounce. He then had to go off and find out from them so that we had it as accurate as possible.
So when you narrated the first Stieg Larsson book, did you realize it was going to be one of the most popular books of the year and the series would go on and be so wildly popular?
Not at all. I'm not plugged into the zeitgeist or whatever. I don't know quite what books are going to be successful. You know, when you're doing a Dickens or a Trollope or one of the classics, that people are going to love it, as long as you do a good job on it. With new novels like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the first of the Larsson series, came out of the blue. I was asked to do it. Seemed like fun. I really enjoyed it. It was a great book. But I've enjoyed other books that have gone nowhere. That this one would be so huge in so many different arenas was something of a surprise to me, and a very pleasant surprise, because in a way it was my first huge success in that sense. I've done things like the O'Brien series of novels, the Aubrey Maturin novels that have been very popular, and I've got lots of responses from. But this one, the Millennium series, has just gone, I don't know, what's the word, viral, whatever. But it's just been extremely popular, and it was quite a surprise to me.
Well, speaking of classics, you've narrated Dickens and Trollope, and as you say, Patrick O'Brien, Oscar Wilde, so many more. I'm wondering, when you prepare to read those books and the stories are so familiar, is it more of a challenge because listeners, readers already have in their head how the characters would sound?
I suppose it is in a small way. I grew up watching classic serials on BBC, or you'd see there was the PBS series over here. So all my life I've been familiar with these stories. But I think maybe that's a benefit, because I've seen, you know, several incarnations of Oliver Twist or other stories. So it's not as if I'm wedded to one particular view of the book. When you do something like V for Vendetta, which was the movie, there is only the one movie, there is only the one book. So there's a sort of, you kind of need to link it in, although I recorded that before the movie came out. But I had, you know, there may have been a little more of a worry there about getting it right. With Dickens presents such a picture of the characters that you're not going to fail whatever you do, as long as you're authentic, as long as you listen to the words, as it were, and he almost always describes a character before they speak. So your mind is already processing as you go along, and then you come out with this voice, and you're not worried about whether it sounds like W.C. Fields or something. Then you just do your own thing. It's always your interpretation. And I mean, you look on Audible, for example, and there's always three or four, five or more versions of a book, and you can't really worry about how authentic you are, to what you're doing. Every narrator brings their own individual style.
Is there a classic novel that has not been recorded yet that you'd like to record?
I honestly couldn't say. I've done so many of the Dickens, and I think there's probably one or two I haven't done. But they'd be the less popular ones. I'm I've been lucky enough to do as many of the classic ones as I think I would have identified in advance. You know, I love doing Thomas Hardy. There's a few there I haven't done, but I've done most of the main ones, Tessa the d'Urbervilles and so on. It's hard to pick out individual books. In a way, as a narrator, because I don't get to choose, I don't necessarily want to sit there going, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. I'm grateful for every book I get, and I love every book I get. And that sounds a bit it's true. I really have no great agenda in terms of what I really want to do.
Well, let's go back to that statement for a while. No names, but haven't you ever had an assignment where the book was a little bit slow going?
Yes. As I say, I love every book, but it's like an actor again saying you have to love the character you're playing, even if it's Adolf Hitler or something. You've got to find something in it that you identify with. And I think that's what I need to do. Yes, there are some books, and generally it's the style of writing. There are some books you feel like you're wading through mud just because it's a very difficult way. It's difficult to get the words up off the page in a lifelike manner, if you like. There are very few that have been particularly difficult, and I honestly can't remember them. As I say, they go in one ear and out the other, and I prefer not to remember the ones I didn't enjoy. But I know there is one I will not name whose storylines just drove me crazy, and those you just... It's like taking bad medicine. You just have to find a way to get through it. You have to find a way to bring it alive. And that's what we do. Yeah.
Well, you do a fabulous job. Your narration is so compelling. It's easy to imagine you dressing for a part as we listen. So how do you prepare to don the multiple roles that you have to take on in one book?
I was just thinking, yes, maybe I should dress up in the appropriate clothes for each book I read. I know that would be quite a sight. In the old days, of course, BBC news readers, I was one, used to dress in dinner jackets and tuxedos to read the news. No, I don't dress. But mentally, yes. Mentally, one does, I suppose, try to take on the eras, particularly with Dickens and so on. It's not... I don't know how I can put it, but I keep relating things to acting because that's what we're doing here. And there's a way in which you can look at somebody like Robert De Niro in isolation from the part he's playing. And he always looks like Robert De Niro. He's often, there's no great change in what he's doing, but because of the surroundings, you totally believe he is in that part. He is that person. He is that character. And I think something like that relates to narration in that you don't have to put on anything. You don't, in fact, it's a mistake to really, put on any special effects in what you're reading or try to create a mood, because then you're just getting in the way of the words. And sometimes just what you're reading is clothing enough. The words are clothing enough, if you like, and you don't need to put anything on. But there is some level in your mind in which you are encompassing the world of the book that you're reading at that time, with if it's a modern book, if it's a classic book or fiction, non-fiction, or whatever style it is, fantasy or science fiction, there's some way in which you're taking on that persona, but you're not consciously putting anything on to affect the interpretation.
And how do you feel about authors who read their own works? Because, I mean, when you listen to a book that you are narrating, I mean, it is so polished and so fabulous. But sometimes when authors read their own works, what's your opinion on that?
It's a mixed bag. There are occasions, there are certain authors who are fantastic. I mean, Neil Gaiman is one of the first ones who comes to mind. And they do have... a direct connection with the material that they've written. And so if they are creatively talented in the direction of narration, then they can bring more to a book than perhaps I could. But they're authors. And you cannot be a jack of all trades. I for the life of me, couldn't write a book. I keep thinking, well, maybe I'd like to, maybe I'd like to try, but I don't have that, whatever powers it takes. You know, I'm in awe of narrators, of authors. I've got a very good friend now, the guy who wrote The Prestige, which is one of my favorite audiobooks, Christopher Priest. They made a movie out of it a couple of years ago, and I visit him every time we go to England. And I said to him this summer when I was over there a couple of weeks ago, you know, I'm just in awe of the creative process. And of course, he dismissed it in the same way that I suppose I can dismiss whatever talent is it is I bring to this. But to get back to the question about, I don't think Christopher Priest would even want to read his own novels. So, but I think there is a place, as I say, for Neil Gaiman and several other, I think Bill Bryson apparently, although I haven't heard any of his work, does a very good job. Of course, one always hates it when an author takes the food out of my mouth. You know, I'd love to be reading his books, but you know, if he does a good job, it's the product that really matters in the end, the result. And if an author can do it, then I think an author should do it. But I don't think an author should do it per se.
Well, all right, very diplomatic answer.
I'm a very diplomatic person.
Yeah, I see. Okay, you've narrated so many of the James Bond books. This is a little off topic, but who, in your opinion, do you think in the films is your favorite Bond?
You know, I don't know. I've been asked this before. I mean, it's a common question. Who is your favorite James Bond in the movies? I think it's always the one who's playing it at the time, pretty much. I must say right now, the one who comes to mind is Daniel Craig. I just loved the first one they did. Was that Casino Royale? It was just fantastic. But it is of its time. And I must say, I loved Sean Connery. You know, I was, as I say, grew up in the 60s, so I saw the first Bond movies in the movie theaters, got very excited about Goldfinger and things like that. I enjoyed Roger Moore. I'm trying to remember the ones in the middle, but then there was the guy before Daniel Craig, whose name slips my mind, but I thought he was very good. I thought he was the best Bond ever at the time he was coming out. Now I think it's Daniel Craig. In a historical sense, who is my favorite? I suppose I'm at an age where nostalgia means a lot, so I love Sean Connery.
Oh,
me
too.
I still love him. But in terms of today, Daniel Craig is fantastic.
Well,
again, diplomatic answer.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Simon. I mean, I just love everything that I listen to, that you read. And I know when the listeners, readers tune into one of your books, they'll feel exactly the same way. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
Alrighty. Bye.
Bye.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Now let's listen to Simon Vance do his thing. In The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, the stunning third and final novel in Stieg Larsson's internationally best-selling trilogy, Lisbeth Salander lies in critical condition in an ICU, a bullet wound to her head. She's fighting for her life in more ways than one. If and when she recovers, she'll be taken back to Stockholm to stand trial for three murders. With the help of her friend, journalist Mikael Blomkvist, she will not only have to prove her innocence, but also identify and denounce those in authority who have allowed the vulnerable, like herself, to suffer abuse and violence. And on her own, she will plot revenge against the man who tried to kill her and the corrupt government institutions that very nearly destroyed her life. Let's listen.
He gently raised her shoulder and located the entry wound in her back. There was no exit wound. The round was still inside her shoulder. He hoped it had not penetrated her lung. and since he did not see any blood in the woman's mouth, he concluded that probably it had not. "Radiology," he told the nurse in attendance. That was all he needed to say. Then he cut away the bandage that the emergency team had wrapped around her skull. He froze when he saw another entry wound. The woman had been shot in the head, and there was no exit wound there, either. Jonasson paused for a second, looking down at the girl. He felt dejected. He often described his job as being like that of a goalkeeper. Every day people came to his place of work in varying conditions, but with one objective: to get help. Jonasson was the goalkeeper who stood between the patient and Fonus Funeral Service. His job was to decide what to do. If he made the wrong decision, the patient might die, or perhaps wake up disabled for life. Most often he made the right decision because the vast majority of injured people had an obvious and specific problem. A stab wound to the lung or a crushing injury after a car crash were both particular and recognizable problems that could be dealt with. The survival of the patient depended on the extent of the damage and on Jonasson's skill. There were two kinds of injury that he hated. One was a serious burn case, because no matter what measures he took, the burns would almost inevitably result in a lifetime of suffering. The second was an injury to the brain. The girl on the gurney could live with a piece of lead in her hip and a piece of lead in her shoulder, but a piece of lead inside her brain was a trauma of a wholly different magnitude. He was suddenly aware of his nurse saying something.
"Sorry, I wasn't listening."
"It's her."
"What do you mean?"
"It's Lisbeth Salander. The girl they've been hunting for the past few weeks for the triple murder in Stockholm."
Jonasson looked again at the unconscious patient's face. He realized at once that the nurse was right. He and the whole of Sweden had seen Salander's passport photograph on billboards outside every newspaper kiosk for weeks. And now the murderer herself had been shot, which was surely poetic justice of a sort. But that was not his concern. His job was to save his patient's life, irrespective of whether she was a triple murderer or a Nobel Prize winner. Or both. Then the efficient chaos, the same in every ER the world over, erupted. The staff on Jonasson's shift set about their appointed tasks. Salander's clothes were cut away. A nurse reported on her blood pressure, 100 over 70, while the doctor put his stethoscope to her chest and listened to her heartbeat. It was surprisingly regular, but her breathing was not quite normal. Jonasson did not hesitate to classify Salander's condition as critical. The wounds in her shoulder and hip could wait until later, with a compress on each, or even with the duct tape that some inspired soul had applied. What mattered was her head. Jonasson ordered tomography with a new and improved CT scanner that the hospital had lately acquired. Jonasson had a view of medicine that was at times unorthodox. He thought doctors often drew conclusions that they could not substantiate. This meant that they gave up far too easily. Alternatively, they spent too much time at the acute stage trying to work out exactly what was wrong with the patient so as to decide on the right treatment. This was correct procedure, of course. The problem was that the patient was in danger of dying while the doctor was still doing his thinking. But Jonasson had never before had a patient with a bullet in her skull. Most likely he would need a brain surgeon. He had all the theoretical knowledge required to make an incursion into the brain, but he did not by any means consider himself a brain surgeon. He felt inadequate, but all of a sudden he realized that he might be luckier than he deserved. Before he scrubbed up and put on his operating clothes, he sent for the nurse. "There's an American professor from Boston working at the Karolinska Hospital in Stockholm. He happens to be in Göteborg tonight, staying at the Elite Park Avenue on Avenyn. He just gave a lecture on brain research. He's a good friend of mine. Could you get the number?" While Jonasson was still waiting for the X-rays, the nurse came back with a number of the Elite Park Avenue. Jonasson picked up the phone. The night porter at the Elite Park Avenue was very reluctant to wake a guest at that time of night, and Jonasson had to come up with a few choice phrases about the critical nature of the situation before his call was put through.
Radio readers, that's all we have time for today. I'm so glad you joined me, and I can't wait until we meet again next week. Thanks again to Erin James for the theme music from her album Soul Garden. By the way, if you like the show or would like to request a book, please drop me an email at input@bookreportradio.com. I'd love to hear from you. This is Elaine Charles. See you next week. Much too late.